Call the meeting of the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee to order. We do have a quorum, and I think we'd like to, first of all, entertain a motion to... do we have the minutes here somewhere?
Yep.
To approve the minutes. They're in your packet, I guess. Do we have a motion?
Chair, I make a motion.
Representative Fogle moves the minutes. Any questions or corrections? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. I'd like to welcome those from the University of Minnesota here, including President Brunix and others. So our agenda calls for an overview, and we appreciate you being here to do that for us. So you may begin.
Chair Nottis, members of the committee, it's great to be back again, although I understand we have some pretty challenging issues we're going to have to resolve in the next several months together. As Chair Nottis indicated, I'm going to give, I hope, a brief overview of the University of Minnesota. I'd like to have some time for your questions and to engage in some dialogue about the future of higher education in the state and the importance of the University of Minnesota to our state's future. I'd like to talk a little bit about the university's role in Minnesota's system of higher education. It's quite unique to talk about our mission and priorities and particularly to touch on the unique role that the university plays in selected areas of education and, of course, in research as your only designated research university. As I begin, I want to acknowledge some people who are here. We have... student leaders from the University of Minnesota who have joined us today, members of our Board of Regents, Regent Cohen, who's Vice Chair of the Board, Regent Hunter, Regent Ramirez, Regent Bonesock, Regent Hung is here, and Regent Beeson, I think, and Regent Larson. Did I miss anyone else? I don't think I missed anyone. But anyway, it's quite a large number of the 12-member board that I'll mention in a few moments. Senior Vice President and Provost Tom Sullivan is here. Senior Vice President for System Administration across the state of Minnesota, Robert Jones, is here. Our Chief Financial Officer is here in case I get into the deep weeds. That's Richard Fitzenreiter. Any of these executives would be happy to field questions if we get into areas of responsibility that they can help us with. I'd like to start with an inscription on Northrop Auditorium, an inscription I see nearly every day and continues to inspire me. And this inscription says, "The University of Minnesota, founded in the faith that men are ennobled by understanding, dedicated to the advancement of learning and the search for truth, devoted to the instruction of youth and the welfare of the state." This university, your university, was founded in 1851, about 7 years before we became a state in the Union. I always find that little tidbit inspiring, that people on wagons came here from different parts of the world, and one of the first things they did was to make an investment in education and in building what I would argue is one of the world's great universities. This university is also a land-grant institution, and we were chartered in 1862 in the middle of the Civil War as one of land-grant universities in the United States. States at that time were giving grants of land to help capitalize the expansion of higher education, particularly in the Midwest and West. And that imposes, in my judgment, some very special responsibilities, that is, to be a land-grant university. Imposes some very special responsibilities on the University of Minnesota to ensure that our work is deeply connected to public issues and the public good. The inscription on Northrop that was set in stone in 1936 had a very interesting discussion. We deliberate a great deal at the University of Minnesota, so figuring out these words and the ordering of the words took about 16 years, as I recall. But they have clearly stood the test of time, and I find it really inspiring that in the depths of a depression, much more serious than we find ourselves in today, people recognized the beauty of human understanding. They saw fit to emphasize their devotion to the advancement of knowledge and the public good, and they saw fit to put it in the very heart of the University of Minnesota. And it inspires me, and I hope it inspires you as well. This next slide is taken out of state statute and then describes the university's distinctive role and mission in Minnesota's system of higher education, and that is to offer undergraduate, graduate, and professional instruction through the doctoral degree, and shall be, according to state language, the primary state-supported academic agency for research and extension services. There are five campuses in the University of Minnesota. I'm going to show you this map of Minnesota, and as I go through my comments, I'm going to add different parts of the University of Minnesota system, and when I finish, there'll be about 45 symbols on this map of our great state, showing that this university is located in every region of Minnesota, conducting work that is vitally important to our regional economies and obviously the advancement of our quality of life. We have five campuses, and you can see them, at least their locations represented on the map. To the northwest, we have a smaller campus, University of Minnesota Crookston. It specializes in undergraduate opportunities. The degree programs are applied, career-oriented four-year degree programs with a very strong emphasis on regional development, regional economic development, regional needs with a strong a rural emphasis. The University of Minnesota Duluth is a mid-sized comprehensive university. It offers a wide range of undergraduate degrees as well as a selected professional and graduate degrees. It has some very specialized programs, particularly in the health sciences, engineering, minerals research, freshwater research, just to name a few. For example, the Rural Health and Physicians Program, it operates in Duluth. Students start there for 2 years and then transfer to the Twin Cities campus. And if you travel across the state of Minnesota, you will find residents from this program in every corner of the state. It is arguably the top program of its kind in the United States today in supplying physicians for rural communities and has been extraordinary in supplying improved health care in American Indian communities and reservations throughout the upper Midwest. Duluth has about 12,500 students. The University of Minnesota Morris, in the western part of the state, provides a rigorous liberal arts education. It's considered one of the top public liberal arts colleges in the nation. It's located on a 121-year-old campus. It started in 1960, but the origin of this campus goes way back to the days when Morris was a territorial Indian school, residential Indian school. University of Minnesota Rochester is a relatively recent addition to the University of Minnesota. It was established in 2006. It is a very specialized campus dealing with academic and professional needs of southeastern Minnesota. Most of the emphasis is on laboratory science and health professional jobs. There are strong partnerships with Mayo Clinic and many of the other health entities in southeastern Minnesota. And it offers, by cooperative arrangement, a number of programs and has for many, many years in electrical engineering. There's an MBA program offered from Duluth and public health from the Twin Cities campus. And so we try to leverage in Rochester not only partnerships with Minsky institutions, but also the four other campuses of the University of Minnesota. Obviously, the Twin Cities is the largest part of our system. It's obviously the most well-known. It's the state's only research university, as I indicated a few moments ago, and it's one of the leading universities of its kind in the United States and in the world today. We're a member of an organization called the American Association of Universities. That's an organization of about 63 public and private research universities across the United States. And these universities comprise the very best universities, not just in this country, but around the world. 40 of the 50 top-ranked international research universities are in the United States, and your University of Minnesota is one of them. We are considered, when you look at research productivity, one of the top 10 public and private institutions in the country. And that's an interesting statistic, but it's more than a statistic. It creates unbelievable economic opportunity and vitality in this state, and I want to spend a little time talking about that in a few moments. This next slide gives you a sense of the complexity of the Twin Cities campus. There are only four campuses in the United States today that offer the sort of breadth and range of academic programs that you find here on the Twin Cities campus, including programs in agriculture, veterinary medicine, engineering, and medical schools. There are very few campuses that provide all of those in one place. There was a time when people would often say to me, don't you think that you're too wide? You have too many programs. And now, increasingly, as we try to solve the major problems facing our world, that breadth and depth is an enormous strength and comparative advantage for the University of Minnesota and our state, and I may have an opportunity to touch on a few of those examples as I proceed through my presentation. And not represented on this slide are numerous what we call interdisciplinary centers, where we bring people together across a wide range of academic fields to work on serious problems, whether we're talking about the solution of issues in our community or the advancement of research and knowledge or technology transfer. Institutes like the Institute for Translational Neuroscience that studies the development of the human brain throughout the lifespan. The Institute on the Environment, Minnesota Population Center, has consulted with China on the design and conduct of its first census, just to give you a sense of the reach of these centers and how they affect not only work here but around the world. We have a world-renowned Center for Transportation Studies, a special set of institutes that deal with health and nutrition, and in particular obesity prevention center, the Center for Bioethics, Biotechnology Institute. So there are a number of these configurations that allow us to bring academic resources together across major fields to serve the interests of our students and also to advance knowledge for the benefit of the university and our state. I'd like to, since I suspect you will spend a little time on money this year, I thought I would spend a little time acquainting you with the university budget. I like to say, and I'm rarely challenged, that this is probably the most complex budget of any organization that I know of in the state of Minnesota. Complex in terms of the source of revenues that fund our program, and I think complex in terms of the activities that generate the overall budget of the university. This budget is roughly about $3 billion a year. The most important portion of this graph for me to emphasize today is on the right-hand side, the gold and maroon parts of the pie chart describe tuition and fee income of the University of Minnesota, and these are in fiscal 2011 figures. And you can see that, tuition is approximately 22% of the university's all-funds budget at the same at this time. State funding is about 18%. There's an additional allocation from the state for state special funding, mostly dedicated to extension, agriculture, the medical school, and selected areas where the state legislature over many, many decades has decided that there are certain priorities that the university should pursue and should be funded separately. I want to make a very strong point that this university leverages your investment. It leverages your investment not in a small way, but in a very substantial way. For every dollar you give us, we bring in $4.5 on our own through our own initiative and through the creative activities of the people who comprise the extended community of the University of Minnesota. That economic activity creates jobs, and I know there's a big debate right now in the public marketplace and the private marketplace about what it takes to grow the economy of our state and what it takes to grow the economy of our country. And I will tell you, and I will emphasize this again throughout my remarks, that you cannot simply create a stronger economic future for Minnesota unless you invest in higher education, and you certainly will not get there unless you keep the research character and the research strength and the educational strengths of the University of Minnesota as strong as you can possibly keep them. The main thing I want to point out is this creates, this investment that you make in us creates tremendous economic activity and creates tremendous numbers of jobs in Minnesota's private economy. At last count, we believe just the research portfolio of the university creates 26,000 jobs a year in Minnesota's private, mostly in Minnesota's private economy. So I'd like to start by talking about the three aspects of the university's mission: research, education, and our public outreach mission or engagement. I'd like to start with research. About 20% of the university's budget is in sponsor, what we call sponsored grants and contracts. Nearly every dollar, or most of these dollars, are generated through competitive means. People write proposals that are reviewed by competitive peer groups, mostly at the federal level, but sometimes and many times in foundations. And our people, to get these grants and contracts and to bring this money into the University of Minnesota, have to compete against the very best. And we think we do that relatively well. The granting agencies then decide what to fund. And I'd like to give you a couple of examples of this kind of activity and what it means to the university and our state. This legislature, in my view, some years ago, made a capital investment in the University of Minnesota that I think is one of the most visionary examples of state investment I've seen in my 42 years of residence in this state, and that is something that created the Biomedical Discovery District. This was an investment of about $280 million of state funding, with the obligation that the university would raise significant amounts of money beyond that for the capital portion of the investment, but also the money needed for laboratories and the hiring of people to work in these very, very critical biomedical fields. I make that point because I think that kind of investment in research and research infrastructure is absolutely a critical role for the state of Minnesota. And let me give you an illustration of what kind of leveraging impact it has. The first investment under the Biomedical Discovery Authority that you granted the University of Minnesota, I might add, on a very bipartisan basis, with I think pretty close to 80% of the people voted in favor of this bill, the first investment was in something called the Magnetic Resonance Research Center. And this is arguably the best center of its kind in the entire world, with the most powerful magnets you can imagine. You can't walk within a block of this place with, if you're wearing heavy metal jewelry, without just getting somehow affected by the magnetic fields. I've said to people that I really do believe we can turn our football program around if we just put a little metal piece in the football when we're on offense and then turn on the magnets, but I haven't been able to convince anyone that that's a pretty good offensive strategy. Camille Ugerville is the brilliant scientist who directs this center. He's been elected to the National Institute of Medicine in 2007. His main area of research is on human brain connectivity, and he studies how regions of the brain interact with one another. It's one of the most exciting areas of research going on around the world at the present time. And he's dealing with issues of great complexity and issues that are not very well understood and have enormous implications for human health and human productivity. He's been selected recently to co-lead a $30 million international effort to map these complex connections of the human brain. And we think breakthroughs in this area are going to one day lead to phenomenal treatments for various neurological diseases like autism, schizophrenia, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and we could go on and name many more. Another research example that shows the extent of our reach in research, but also the extent to which these investments create enormous economic activity and potential partnerships is the Nanofabrication Center. This is another one of those premier centers that is working on what we think may be the next generation of ideas that will really create great breakthroughs in technology and in human health. This particular center, the Nanofabrication Center, supports the work of approximately 155 university faculty members in 8 different departments. But there are 24 companies and 28 colleges and universities in Minnesota and across the United States and Canada that access this particular facility. Why? Because you can't afford to put these facilities in every location. It's just too expensive. And it's also a way that we can access the necessary funding to cover the cost of this center on an ongoing basis. These research grants are vitally important to Minnesota and to the businesses that we try to support through the university and through our state. They fund graduate students, researchers, laboratory staff, and particular forms of research equipment, but they rarely provide funding for capital investment. So we could not build the expansion of the magnetic resonance research facility with a federal grant. That kind of capital investment is rarely given to universities or other entities in our society. So it makes the point, I want to come back to that initial statement I made about how important, how visionary the biomedical discovery investment was. And I will predict that, you know, the seeds that grow mighty oaks, that's one of those seeds you planted as a legislature. You did it on a bipartisan basis. It was one of the most inspiring acts I've seen in the Minnesota legislature. And I will predict that it will grow and expand the biomedical industries of Minnesota. Arguably one of the centers and pillars of Minnesota's economy at the present time. The main point I want to argue is that this part of the university's mission drives innovation, it spurs economic growth, and it clearly improves our quality of life. The National Science Foundation puts out annual reports on research activity for universities across the nation. The university ranked 10th, as I think I mentioned a moment ago, among the nation's top public and private research universities, and 8th among the publics. Most of this money comes from the federal government, and the largest single source of funding is from the National Institutes of Health, and it probably is the most competitive grant process that I know of anywhere in the world. In fiscal 2010, university faculty and staff brought $823 million of research activity into the university and into our state. That was a 36% increase over the previous year. And if you look at the growth in the last 4 or 5 years and you benchmark us against the top universities in the country, we have really gained. We already started with a fairly high baseline, but the rate of growth for the University of Minnesota has really exceeded most of the public and private peers that we benchmark ourselves against in the country. We estimate, as I indicated, that this creates at least 26,000 jobs directly in Minnesota's economy. I once asked one of the people wandering through my office that I thought was a little underemployed on a particular day, if he would go into some of the statistical archives and give me a sense of how the university would stack up against Minnesota's 100 largest companies if we just based our productivity on this research activity of $823 million. I think you'd be interested to know that we would be 38th on this list out of the top 100 top 100 businesses in the state of Minnesota, just based on this indicator alone. And if you add in out-of-state tuition, you add in revenues from research discoveries from the Honeycrisp apples, Desiogen, AIDS prevention or AIDS treatment drug, that standing would be pretty close to the top 30 among the vibrant businesses in Minnesota. And I don't have to remind you that Minnesota, on a per capita basis at least, I believe, leads the country in terms of having close to 23 Fortune 500 level companies, and I think about 20 of the 23 or 19 of the 23 are publicly traded. The next chart shows the units of the university that bring in most of the money. Obviously, most of this comes in areas like science and engineering and the medical sciences, but public health is also a very, very big player. The College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences, we actually took two colleges and combined them a few years ago, and I think this has added a lot of strength to our work in this area. And the College of Education and Human Development are the top five individual colleges with respect to annual research awards. We've seen some phenomenal growth in selected areas, and these have been areas where we have made some very important targeted investments. We believe that we have a real obligation to shape the long-term future of the university by setting priorities and investing wisely. So we've invested in areas like public health. We've had a 74% increase in awards in a single year in the area of public health. The College of Biological Sciences, close to a 68% increase. Veterinary medicine, really good news story. It wasn't too long ago people were talking about closing the College of Veterinary Medicine. I think that was before I started to send my animals there. But anyway, horses and dogs mostly. There's been a 51% increase there. The medical school has gone up 26%. So this is a really very, very strong profile of accomplishment in areas where, as a university and as a state, we have made some very, very important and targeted investments. The next slide sort of summarizes this trend line in sponsored funding, and I don't need to spend a lot of time on it. The following slide, I will say one thing. There was this stimulus money that the federal government put out, and they gave us a chance to go after competitive grants, and we really organized ourselves to get the grants out the door. We got nearly 1,000 grants out in a period of about 6 months. We had nearly 350 awards, $208 million of additional economic activity came into the state. I think we were, if not the top in the Big Ten, pretty close. I'm really proud of the kind of competitiveness of the University of Minnesota and the willingness of our people to really get out there and work hard. I was at a faculty meeting in the medical school, and one of the chair of the meeting said, "I'm really sorry, President Brunix, your time is up. I've got three grants to get out tomorrow morning. This meeting is done." But it gives you a sense this is a very, very entrepreneurial culture where people really work hard and compete against the very best in the world. We have totally revamped our technology commercialization operation in the last few years, largely under the great leadership of Vice President Mulcahy. And you can get a sense for some of the growth rates. We're up about 50% in new licensing agreements, disclosures of major discoveries, and we were up in revenue generating agreements by 30%. We launched 8 startup companies in the last year and a half or so, and 7 of those are in Minnesota. Our first approach is to try, when we license a new technology, to try to locate it in Minnesota, and we look outside of our state borders when we don't have the capacity in our state, and that's generally in some areas of pharmaceutical development. Only then do we look elsewhere to see if we can find the best sort of match between the technology and our potential to develop it. I am often asked, well, can't you grow yourself out of a budget problem by just commercializing more technology? And the answer is no, it's a fool's errand. You should nurture and grow ideas and find ways to get them into the marketplace, but it's not a predictable source of year-in and year-out revenue. But we have had a big blockbuster at the University of Minnesota. It's called Ziogen. It has produced about $50 million a year. In our approach to technology commercialization, we plow most of that money back into the core research infrastructure of the university, try to do it in a way that builds long-term capacity. We don't try to use it just to plug budgetary holes at the University of Minnesota. We've tried to be very, very thoughtful about it.
President Brunix,
yes.
We have a question, if we can interrupt for just a moment.
You can. I could use
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, President Brunig is going to have a drink of water. Perfect. And thank you for being here today. I'm grateful to you for pointing out the significance of the research that's being done at the University of Minnesota. I'm grateful to you. You mentioned the $1 generating $4.50. I have to imagine there's also a negative relationship as funding's cut from the state, that there's a loss of being able to access dollars. I don't know if it's a $1 to $4.50 relationship as well, but I have to imagine that it affects your ability to get research grants and the like. My question for you, and speaking as a faculty member, I'm imagining as faculty lines are cut, as administrative lines, as departmental help is cut, as faculty find themselves stretched, it becomes more and more difficult for them to apply for the grants, do the research. So I was going to ask you to, if you could expand a little bit upon what is the effect on the ability of the university going forward to do research, to apply for grants as cutbacks occur to faculty and to staff.
Okay. President Brunig.
Chair Narnes, Representative Morrow, that's a great question, and I've even tried to gather some statistical evidence. We took a $185 million cut in the two-year period in the last recession, the sort of dot-com recession, and my Vice President for Research, who's probably more truthful to using data than I am, reminds me to be careful about how I use the statistics, but actually in that two-year period, rather than the growth rate going up, it went down about $15 million. That was back in the earlier part of this decade. And that happens for a number of reasons. One thing that happens when you have deep budget cuts is one of the ways you have to deal with them is you have to suspend hiring. And you usually suspend hiring of new people in these critical fields, these fields that are advancing into sort of new frontiers, and that so you pay a double price. You're kind of behind the curve, and that happened to the University of Minnesota in biological sciences, and we had to pay a very stiff premium to rebuild ourselves in that area of research in the last 15 years. So I think there is a real cost. We have tried through increasing productivity and building better infrastructure to try to blunt those impacts, but there's a real limit because the people who get these grants out the door are very, very talented and creative people, and you've got to keep hiring them in the right places and in the right fields. And so it's one of my deepest worries when I get up in the morning as to whether we can keep this kind of phenomenal rate of growth and this phenomenal achievement going. The other thing that worries me some is that we will break this connection, this marvelous connection we have had between the federal government and supporting research and development since World War II, since the end of World War II, and our great universities. We've built the greatest universities in the world largely because we've had this magical partnership between the states and the federal government and universities like the University of Minnesota. So if we continue to disinvest, not just here, but in Washington, so if NIH funding goes down, we will be in the business of exporting medical research, biomedical research, and the best technologies in the world to other parts of the world, to other countries of the world, if you will. And that is not good for the nation, and it's clearly not good for the state of Minnesota. We have a lower unemployment rate here because we have those industries, and we're a world leader in these areas. And it's very, very difficult. It has taken 50 to 60 years to build this kind of world leadership in Minnesota, and it can slip away, and companies can move in an instant from Minnesota and relocate their plants and their research operations in China. And many of Medtronic, I think, built a major research lab in Shanghai not too long ago. I think it was in Shanghai, but that's the kind of thing that can happen in this global marketplace, and it can happen overnight. So I think one wise person said chance favors the prepared mind. I think we need to be prepared for this, and we need to make the right investments. I understand the need to balance budgets and to deal with the economic realities that face us. As I sit before you, this is the fifth biennial budget that I will have prepared with my colleagues for your consideration, and three of those five have been in the midst of recessions, or at least have touched on recessions, and have been surrounded by the prospect of deep budget cuts. So I understand these economic realities, but I think your comment, Representative Morrow, is directly on target. We have to take a look. We have to solve our immediate problems, but we have to do it wisely, set priorities, and take a long-term view. And I would argue the university ought to be in that long-term vision.
President Brunig, we have another question. Representative Bennion.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. President Brunig, the way you presented this connection between the dollar of state appropriations and the remainder of your budget, to my ears as both a faculty member and someone who's taught macroeconomics at the principal's level, sounded like an implication that $1 would lead to $4.5 in either direction. I don't know that that's what you meant, and I'm quite sure it's not, but I want to make sure we're clear on that. And I also want to follow up with that. And we can just cover these both quickly. You said during the last cut, last time we had tough budgets back in the last recession, a cut of $185 million to your budget led to a decrease in grants of $15 million. Did I get that right? Which is a much $15 million. Okay, so that's a much smaller. So that's a number that implies some net savings. Nevertheless, am I right about that? Did I summarize it correctly?
Yes.
Thank you.
Chair Narnes, Representative Bannion, I do want to point out, though, that we raised tuition 29% during that period. We really cut budgets deeply. There were additional years, probably another two, before we could get back on our feet and start sending those trend lines in the right direction. There isn't a one-to-one correspondence in any kind of economic model. We will produce for the legislature and our Board of Regents in the month of February and in subsequent months a set of reports that will talk about the economic return and the economic impact of the University of Minnesota. My main point is there's not a dollar-for-dollar transfer between your investment and productivity, but there is a tremendous rate of return for the investment you make at the University of Minnesota.
There can be a
tipping point. If you drive those investments down too low, you have a weak and a poor infrastructure, you will not recruit the best people, you will not keep the best people, and you will not be as productive in the future as you have been in the past.
Representative Mr. Chairman, thank you. President Brunig, I didn't mean to imply all the things that you were saying. I just wanted to make sure we were clear that the statement you were making was not to be implied by anybody in the room here as suggesting some multiplier of 4.5.
No.
And that's the limit of what I wanted to get to. I don't disagree with all that, but those are arguments still to be fleshed out, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Chair Nordis. President Brunig, I figured first off I should probably follow Representative Bannion. Apparently they swapped our pictures. In
have
the directory.
You seen the website?
And I feel terrible for you. I got this really handsome picture now next to my name.
Representative NIU.
But first, Mr. President, I did want to compliment your Board of Regents on being so well represented here. That is meaningful, at least to this humble legislator, as well as your top staff being with us as well. Not that you're a singular act all in and of yourself, but it's terrific to have those that sort of support. My question is somewhat twofold. The University of Oregon made a, and I should probably direct it to the chair. Would you ever entertain what the University of Oregon proposed? Maybe I shouldn't even ask the question. What they proposed was a you talk about blowing up the box. They asked that the legislature provide them with a lump sum, and then they wouldn't come back anymore. The way that they went about it was that currently, I think, in Oregon, they pay like $800 million a year, or spend $800 million a year to the University of Oregon. And that has kind of ebbed and flowed, just like it has in so many other states across the country. They suggested to the state that why don't you just give us $15 billion or whatever the amount was, and we will work off of that. We'll use the interest and some of the principal off of that. Brilliant. And we won't come back to see you again for 30 years. With the idea being then that you would have some predictability. You wouldn't have to worry about the ups and downs that we would have. There was also the expectation that by virtue of investment, that the return on that would be better than what may otherwise be provided by the state. So it's in a roundabout way, Mr. Chairman, it's a question to you. But I'm curious from President Brunix whether it's that, which is a kind of a bold, you talk about blowing up the box kind of idea, or if there is any other approaches that you've taken other than this. You made the comment that brought it to mind. You've been here 5 years. It's been tough times. It's kind of been up and down. I got to imagine for your budgeting process to have that sort of unpredictability, not knowing what you're going to have, let alone this year, next year. Well, shoot, this afternoon we may whack you again. But literally over to have a little bit more predictability, if you've thought about other funding mechanisms.
President Brunix.
Yeah, Chair Narnes, Representative Atkins, we clearly have, and that's been a big topic of conversation around the country. I have spoken out on this publicly in recent years. I've talked about sort of resetting the compact between the university and, I would say, between higher education and the state of Minnesota. It is very difficult to make long-term investments, to plan, and to maintain a strong infrastructure when you're on a roller coaster funding sort of paradigm. And so I do think that requires real consideration. We need to make higher education a major priority for the long-term investment of our state. If we don't, I can assure you, just in my humble opinion, that we are making a deliberate decision to compromise our own future and the future of our children and communities. So that doesn't mean we need to solve it all now. But I do believe we need to enter into sort of a new sort of agreement or compact, one that allows us to plan, and I would argue for us to be more accountable for the results that we need to produce for the state of Minnesota. Now, whether it's better to ask for $30 billion that you'd put into a long-term endowment or to come before you on a biennial or more frequent basis, I'm not really prepared to say. There's no research out there that says that's a particularly good model. It feels a little to me like a Hail Mary pass, to be honest with you, and it's probably not a bad thing for the outgoing presidents. Presidents have a life expectancy of major universities of 4.5 years, and so you can pass that on to future generations of presidents. But I think there is something very special about coming before you every year and making the case on behalf of the University of Minnesota. And I think there's more accountability on us to deliver the results that you have a right to expect. And it's I think it's a better framework for us to enter into a deep discussion about the things that really matter with respect to shaping the future of our own state. So I would prefer a different kind of process, something between what I consider to be I don't think it's a Hail Mary pass necessarily. I use that metaphor because I mainly throw Hail Mary passes every day in my job. But I think there's got to be something in between these two models that would give us more predictability. Maybe it's setting real expectations about what the funding stream should look like over time. We should be more strategic and maybe setting our priorities to make sure we protect the things that are going to matter most to us 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now. But I do think we ought to be exploring the revisiting of this compact with the state and thinking about the roles and responsibilities that we enjoy and should preserve in Minnesota's great system of higher education.
We'll let you get back to your planned presentation in a moment, but we have Connie Demke. Representative Demke has a question.
Hello, Dr. Brunix. Nice to see you again, and thank you very much for coming today. I have a particular interest in K-12 education. I've spent many years in that area, and We had a terrific presentation this morning, and we were told that the university has gone into partnership. It's called the Next Teacher Partnership with the Bush Foundation, and that three of your and the reason I'm bringing this up now, waiting to the end, is that you talked about accountability to the state of Minnesota, and I understand that that program. One of the goals is guaranteeing the graduates' effectiveness for teachers, our K-12 teachers. And it's all about thinking about how can we partner with the K-12 education. You're working with a lot of others. And I just was wondering if this is an appropriate time, Mr. Chair, to ask him a question about continuing on this, or would you like me to wait to the end?
If we can take a moment now.
I brought it up because you said about accountability, and I thought this was a great time to bring it up. But talk to me about this program. And there was a comment made by one of the Bush presenters, Ms. Hegard, said that the people that she's working with in the university system have had to have a lot of courage to step forward to work in this area and to really work in a partnership way. And so I thank you for your courage, and if you could just kind of talk to us about your direction in that program. Yes,
President Brunix.
Chair Narnas, Representative Deputy, I know a great deal about this program. In fact, we're going to have a site visit next week at the University of Minnesota. I think this is a fabulous program because it reminds us that it isn't just important to prepare people for the schools or to prepare people for medical practice. You also have to be responsible for how well they perform after they leave. You can't be totally responsible because people make decisions each and every day, and obviously the context of your work influences your outcomes. But my feeling is this is a good model for a number of reasons. First of all, I think it will lead to better professional preparation programs, but I think it will also be a real strong source of renewal. So by keeping connected to people after you educate them, this has been a long-standing practice, incidentally, at the University of Minnesota. We've done follow-up studies on our students for several decades now, as students who prepared for teaching the teaching profession. So I think it's a great program, but the whole area of connecting higher education to K-12, I think, should be a part of this broader discussion that Representative Atkins raised in his question. We need to be thinking in our state, and this gets me a little off track, but we need to think about a long-term human capital agenda. This summer, Representative Narnas and several other people joined together to think about the connection between the early lives of children and their entry into school, their preparation for the early grades of our elementary schools. So I think we need to be thinking more seamlessly about this in terms of human capital terms, and I think there's a great deal that we can do by joining hands with the K-12 system to improve the quality of outcomes in our schools. You might be interested to know that about the average student entering Morris or Duluth or the Twin Cities campus now has well over 25 credits of college-related work by the time they step on our campus. And if we were more planful about it, let's just simply say for the sake of argument that there was a stronger connection in the last 2 years of high school between our colleges and universities and our K-12 system, we probably could share costs much more effectively. But just think about it for a moment. If a student came into the University of Minnesota and carried with him or her a full year of academic work, that would be like getting a $25,000 scholarship right out of the chute. And so I think there are a lot of creative ideas like this that Kent Pikella at the University of Minnesota is working on through the College Readiness Consortium. This consortium really works as a partnership with the schools to help get young people better prepared for the rigors of higher education. So I think that's all a part of this broader compact discussion that I think we need to have in our state. As I segue into a new phase of my life, and I leave the presidency in June and July, I plan to spend a good deal of my personal time working with people inside and outside the university on these issues. But I think this connection between higher education and our K-12 system needs to be strengthened greatly And I think there are enormous opportunities. This state has been extremely creative in this area with the college and the schools concept, post-secondary education options. I mean, and we need to keep that creativity going so that we make sure that the investment we started making in the late 50s to turn our economy around, mainly an investment through strengthening education, continues in the 21st century.
Thank you, Dr. Brunis. I agree with you 100%, and it would be a pleasure to have you stay in that area. I think it's one of the things that's going to really help us get those kids ready for the workforce. Yeah. We really need that. Thank you.
Well, just I think college readiness is the new education standard for the 21st century. 70% of the new jobs in Minnesota's economy in the long-term future are going to be jobs that require extensive college education, if not four-year degrees. And it's one of the reasons we have a lower unemployment rate in Minnesota, and it's one of the reasons if we make the wise judgments that we can continue to be a top 10 economy in the United States going forward. At one time, we had a per capita income in the state of Minnesota as late as 1959 that was ranked 29th in the country. And we moved from 29th to about 7th, largely because we had the smarts and the commitment to invest in education in ways that I think have been really creative. Let me just, I'll try to speed up a little bit, but I love questions, as you can tell. I've been advised by my colleagues that I need to shorten my answers, however. That's going to be a harder thing for me to accomplish. I'd like to spend a little time on education. The educational mission of the university, according to our public opinion surveys, is the most highly regarded aspect of our mission and the most highly regarded thing that we do. We serve about 68,000 full-time equivalent students each year. We have extensive graduate and professional programs in the Twin Cities, Duluth, and Rochester. The National Research Council recently reported the university as a premier institution in graduate education. It evaluated 69 of our graduate programs, the second highest number of evaluations in this particular survey. And if you look at the range of academic programs in the university, you find programs like chemical engineering, material science. It's always ranked one or two in the country. Child psychology, material science and engineering, mechanical engineering, and many, many other fields like food sciences, civil engineering, ecology, evolution and behavior, aerospace engineering. These are all among the very, very strongest programs that we have at the University of Minnesota. The undergraduate curriculum is one of the broadest in the country. And it is a real source of pride to me that the undergraduate education that occurs on the campuses of the University of Minnesota is better than it has ever been, at least in modern history. And one of the things you can look at, if you just look at the Twin Cities, for example, applications to our campus in the fall of 2006 for freshman admission, we usually admit about 5,200 to 5,300 students as freshmen. We're at about 24,000, close to 25,000. This year they're close to 37,000. 50% increase has occurred in the last 5 years. I think that's because people recognize this is incredible quality, while the costs are growing up, people recognize that they're getting an incredible value for their investment. 43% of our students in the freshman class were in the top 10% of their high school class this year, compared to 33% in the fall of 2003. We've really made a concerted effort to work with our schools and school systems to strengthen the preparation of incoming students. It's a little like the old E.F. Hutton ad. When you make the point that preparation matters, people listen. And people say to me, as I travel around the state, people in K-12 education, keep talking about these issues. You're helping us do our job, and you're helping us get across to students that it's important to take the right classes, and it's important to apply yourself each and every day. degrees this year, we awarded close to 14,000 degrees. This has been an area where we've really increased our productivity, actually close to 15,000, but the numbers have really gone up. We've increased over 600 undergraduate degrees granted per year, over 400 master's degrees, 250 doctoral degrees compared to just 5 years ago. So we've added a lot of student capacity. There are about 12,500 additional full-time students enrolled in campuses of the University of Minnesota in the last several years. That's the size of the entire Duluth campus student body. That's been done with little or no increase in faculty, and I regard that as one of our leading measures of productivity and increases in productivity. The one thing that's also interesting to note in the educational profile and the educational programs of the University of Minnesota is we do offer a much higher proportion of degrees in the health sciences or the health-related sciences, and in what we call STEM fields of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. In fact, about 40% of the degrees across the state at the undergraduate level are in the STEM-related fields, about 75% of the master's degrees and about 90% of the doctorates, and many of those people go into the laboratories of Medtronic and many of the other leading companies in the state of Minnesota. Graduation rates have not been a real source of pride at the University of Minnesota, but we've really made it a very important and significant priority to increase these graduate rates. They've nearly doubled in the last several years, and our goal is to raise them to the 60% level by 2012. I think we'll get there, and we're making really steady progress in keeping retention rates at about the 90% level. It's all because we're putting very significant funding in these critical years of transition for transfer students. We take about 2,000 transfer students across the state of Minnesota. We want to make sure they make that transition from mostly community colleges to the university and do it successfully. We also have a very, very strong emphasis on giving extraordinary help and support to freshmen when they enter the campuses of the University of Minnesota, and that helps increase these retention rates, increases and improves academic achievement, and I think provides a much better education for our students. The area of financial access and affordability has been a big priority of the Board of Regents and of the university's administration. We felt at least in the early years of my tenure that we were lagging in terms of providing scholarship support for students. We started something called the Promise for Tomorrow Scholarship. We went all over the country. We hit people up to give back to the University of Minnesota. At that time, we were raising $5 to $7 million a year in scholarship support. We moved that to $40 to $60 million in this roughly 6-year period, and ended up raising $320 million for increasing support in our long-term endowment. We've had, actually, in the month of December, the best scholarship fundraising month in the university's history. So people are recognizing that the cost of education is going up. They're recognizing that they have to give back, and I think this is a good news story at the University of Minnesota. It's allowed us to start something called the University of Minnesota Promise Scholarship. I think it's the best need-based scholarship program in the United States. It's funded with internal money and also private support. It now supports 13,000 low and moderate income Minnesota residents statewide. We've also increased, as you can see in this slide, support for graduate and professional support. The university provides more money through private and internal support for students at the undergraduate level than the combined total of resources we get from the state grant program and the federal funding programs that are available for students. I think that should be our responsibility together to make sure we keep higher education accessible and affordable. These scholarship programs have allowed us in the last 9 years to keep the net cost increase for Minnesota residents down to about 3% a year, which I think is a phenomenal record. The nominal rates have gone up, but we've been really very successful with these scholarship and I think also with student very high level of student employment to keep debt down it's still too high, but also to keep higher education accessible and affordable going forward. I'd like to make just a few comments about the university's public mission. I started by talking about the Land Grant Act of 1862. This is a big part of the university's mission. It's the one I worry about most frequently. This gets to Representative Depke's question about the connection of the university to public purposes and to public values. And in times of financial stringency, there's a tendency to sort of think that it's necessary to divest oneself of many of these responsibilities. I take quite an opposite view. In fact, if you do it well, you can actually increase your revenues and resources. We have, as you know, the extension responsibilities for the state of Minnesota. Nearly a million people from Minnesota participate annually in extension programs. We've had close to 20 million annual visits to the extension website from not only across the United States but around the world. Extension has been chosen as a leader by the Northwest Area Foundation to fight poverty in the upper Midwest, along with other leading universities, to work on issues of obesity and related health problems. Recently, the university received millions of dollars of NIH and other awards with health partners and other entities in our state to work on these health and nutrition issues. We think they have the potential to really drive down health care costs. The university was named in 2004 as one of three Homeland Security Centers of Excellence. We received an initial $15 million grant that's been renewed. This is a phenomenal partnership. We have some sectors in our state economy that are really very, very significant worldwide leaders, and one is in the area of foods and health. And this center works to really protect the global food supply. It includes partnerships with governments around the world. There are about 20 businesses that are a part of this consortium, and about 6 to 8 of them of the most significant businesses in our state. You know, the Land O'Lakes, Cargill, General Mills, just to name a few, are all a part of this very, very active consortium. And it is one of, as you know, one of the leading issues that we face in the country. And I'm really proud of the fact that our extraordinary academic resources allow us to take really worldwide leadership in this area. We've established research and outreach centers. We have them located around the state. You can see them on this map. These research and outreach centers are mostly in agriculture and natural resources, but some are in the area of the environment. There's a recent urban research and outreach center that Senior Vice President Jones has led, and recently that received a $3 million Department of Commerce grant to improve computer labs and computer capacity, computer infrastructure in low-income communities throughout Minnesota. There's also grants in this center dealing with health disparities research and a good many other areas that have to do with nutrition, education, and economic development. It just gives you a flavor of the many things that are happening in the area of supporting Minnesota's needs on a statewide basis. One of the most exciting areas is the area health education centers. Here, these centers are located across Minnesota, largely funded by federal grants. They allow the university to work with communities on health workforce issues and a good many other concerns. So let me just quickly sum up a few points. I think you can see the university's statewide reach and impact. I want to make the point again that this university is Minnesota's only comprehensive research university. It provides life-changing education, in my view, and particularly in critically important fields to our future. The alumni of the university go out and create businesses. They have created 10,000 companies in Minnesota, 9,000 across the nation. They employ 500,000 people in Minnesota, another 600,000 nationally. They generate $100 billion in annual revenue in Minnesota. We're just talking about the alumni of the University of Minnesota, and another $130 billion nationally. This is a university that conducts breakthrough research. That research drives innovation and I believe addresses the most significant priorities of our state. And it's also a university that is in a very dynamic and deliberate way connected to the public purposes, public values of our state, and the public needs of our state. Finally, I just want to make one come back to some earlier themes. If you want to grow jobs in Minnesota's economy, I don't think you can do it without a strong research university in the middle of it. Richard Florida has written very eloquently, makes the point a strong university, research university, is a critical piece of the infrastructure needed in the creative economy of the 21st century. Our own state economist, Stinson, has talked about the critical importance of investing in research and innovation in creating jobs and economic growth. Rolnick and Grunwald have talked about the importance of investing in human capital. Art Rolnick was the most recent is the most recent director of the Federal Reserve Bank Research Program, and there are many, many other economists that have talked about these issues quite eloquently and written quite eloquently about them. I think investing in the university is all about investing in Minnesota's future. It doesn't mean we get a pass when the economy is tough. I understand that. But I do think we have to take this long-term view that was introduced by Representative Adkins' questions. The university plays an important, I think an essential leadership role in the regional economic growth of this area, improving our quality of life by providing human capital in key fields, and the new knowledge, innovation, and public engagement that fuels this state's creative economy. I want to end there. I want to thank you for giving me this time, and if we still have time, I'd really like to entertain further questions and comments.
Appreciate you coming. You always do a tremendous job, and very informative. I had just a question, a curiosity, I guess. I was at a meeting up in Detroit Lakes last Saturday dealing with a couple of pests that are in our lakes up there. One is a zebra mussel, but the other one is what they call a flowering rush. And what got my attention during that discussion was they said the research into how to kill this flowering rush was being done in, I think they said, Mississippi.
And so they probably exported it to us.
I don't know where, but I'm just wondering the process. To me, I'd rather have the university involved in that, since the problem is fairly close by. And this is a nasty weed that continues to spread, and it's heading my way. And it's coming down the Pelican River, will soon be in the Otter Tail River, and then soon in the Red Lake River, and who knows, it'll be up in Canada.
Yeah.
So I'm just asking about the process of how this research is done. Is that a competitive thing? How would they be selected and not the university, do you think?
Chair Narnes, I don't know the history behind that particular research effort, but it's not uncommon for us to work with other universities around the country or for other universities to be in our state to address significant issues. I will say that our people are really responsive in dealing with just an incredible range of research problems and issues that that face our state, and many of them have very, very practical implications and outcomes. Representative Rukavina called me one afternoon, and he said, "Do you have anybody at the university that knows anything about mesothelioma? We have a significant challenge on the iron range that we want you to assess." And he was surprised that I had someone on a plane the next day who happened to be the world's expert in that area. So we try to really be responsive to issues that arise in the economy or in the communities of our state. And it's not all funded. Sometimes we find a way to bootstrap these connections to ongoing work at the University of Minnesota. But I would guess that even though this is the University of Mississippi initiative at the present time, there are people at the university like Deborah Schwackhammer who are really on top of these issues and working with people around the state to address them.
Well, I'm hoping that the university somewhere does get connected.
We need to.
The DNR is involved, and there's a lot of folks that are working on finding a solution. And it's kind of reverse of what you maybe will typically do. we're trying to kill this plant. We're trying to find ways to actually,
yes,
you know, and it's so powerful, the roots go so deep that you can actually use a chemical and kill the plant, but it comes right back. So it's an unusual pest. And so anyway, I just throw that out.
Yeah, I think there are dozens and dozens of examples like that where we're working on issues of plant pathology or environmental degradation or water quality. I mean, we're just working on these issues all the time. But I will definitely ask someone to take that back, and I'll find out if we can get more engaged and be more helpful.
Well, appreciate that. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And President Brunix, thank you for your 42 years and especially the last 10 years at the University of Minnesota. I have a question here. In the Minnesota Daily article published in, believe it or not, December 2008, you made a statement, and I'm quoting your statement, "I think that we have more administration than we need, and we need to simplify the process and ask whether we need all the administration at all levels." Okay, my question is, having this process been simplified since you made these statements, and how have you answered your own question?
President Brunix?
Chair Norris, Representative Detmer, I was one of the reasons I'm one of the things I'm doing is I'm leaving my office in June, and that should help. We're going to have a very, I know, a very successful transition to my successor. We've really made this a priority. There's less than 0.5% of the employees of the University of Minnesota that are in high-level administrative positions. And you see vice presidential titles come and go at the university, but we've cut at least two major vice presidencies. We've closed colleges. We're down about 4 to 5 major dean positions. So we have really trimmed our sails. There's some additional trimming that will be done in the next few months. But, for example, the senior vice president's position for academic health and the dean of the medical school position was combined. It is now vice president and dean of the medical school. It's a combined position. That was not a small, trivial undertaking. We closed 3 colleges before universities discovered it was something that needed to be considered and reintegrated them into larger administrative configurations. Some of our coordinate campuses have reduced vice chancellors. Increasingly, our coordinate campuses are leveraging the technology and the administrative capability of the Twin Cities campus. That's true of Morris, Crookston, and Rochester in particular. And I happen to believe this is something you work on constantly. There are ways to trim our costs. There aren't as many dollars to be saved as sometimes people realize. We spend about 65 cents of every dollar on people, and not that many of them are at these high administrative ranks. But I've made it a priority to really consolidate, reduce departments and colleges and academic programs, and I think our record's pretty good in that area. We've really, though, gone after serious cost centers. The serious cost centers have to do with the people we employ and the productivity of our people. We've introduced retirement incentive programs twice in the last, 6 or 7 years. Our workforce is down at least, 550 to 600 people, despite this phenomenal growth in revenues from other sources that I reported in research. So we've really been trying to trim our sails, really become much leaner and more focused, leverage technology much more to get our work done. And I don't think the university by any stretch of the imagination is bloated with administration. I think we can be leaner and meaner, and we will be. There's just no question about it. But I want to do it in a way, and I know the Board of Regents and the university community want to set our course in a way that we think can preserve the long-term academic strengths of the university. But we're deeply mindful. Any question that I get of a tough nature in this area for the Minnesota legislature pales, I can assure you, in comparison to the tough questions I get from our students and faculty. So this has to be uppermost in our mind, but it's not, in some cases, the most serious issue that I think we need to face.
Do we have a couple of more questions? Again, Representative Dittmer, you have another question? You know, oh, you're okay. Then we'll move on to...
I was a little worried when he started to quote the Minnesota Daily on me and something like that.
Representative Demke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a comment and I have a question. First of all, I'd like to second Representative Nornes's concern about local investigation on the invasive species. Representative Nornes, as being the representative from the Lake Minnetonka area, obviously, and 250,000 people visit that lake on an annual basis, we discovered zebra mussels this summer. And so I spent a lot of my summer working with local officials, the DNR, the Minnehaha Watershed Creek people, and the Army Corps of Engineers and so forth. But one of the things that we learned that I thought was really interesting is that a lot of these invasive species have invaded in other areas of the country. But what we have learned is that what can affect them, and the most effective way is to have a local, like the university or a local center, really look at it from our topography, our water, different water quality, temperatures, you know, our climate and all of that. So it really, in order to effectively contain them, we need a local place too. So thank you very much for agreeing to stay involved in that. As you are going to be leaving in June, and we're all sorry to see you go, but you do have a life, and I think that's great that you're going on to other things. Could you explain to this committee the process that the university underwent to hire the next president of the university and your replacement? It'd be interesting for us to know.
If you can keep it as brief as possible.
Well, I can keep it very brief because I wasn't involved in it. That Chair Simmons has joined us and over here, right? And she chaired the committee. I don't know if you want to take a few minutes to answer this question. We'd be happy to, I think, address it.
If we can do it quickly. Then.
Yeah, I will say as she comes to the microphone, one of the things that you have in Minnesota as a research and land-grant university is an incredible network and connections with all the other research centers in the country that address these issues. And so when I get the call on whether we know anything about mesothelioma, if we don't, we can find very quickly in our network where the centers of excellence are to address the needs of Minnesota. And that to me is a very big strength and comparative advantage of the University of Minnesota and of our state.
Please identify yourself for the record, and then if you can briefly answer the question.
My name is Patricia Simmons. I'm a regent of the University of Minnesota. Thank you, Chair Nornes, and thank you for the question. My answer will be much briefer than the process. The process in selecting the next president of the University of Minnesota began quite a long time ago, with the regents developing an understanding based on input from a broad constituency around our state of what our state needs going into the future, and therefore what our university needs in its leadership. So it was a long sort of preliminary process. We interviewed many, many people across this state, hundreds, to understand the needs. We then formed, the regents approved the formation of a search advisory committee that consisted of faculty and, again, citizens from around the state who could really add value to helping to identify candidates, vet those candidates, and narrow down a list that met the criteria we were looking for to serve up to the board itself. The committee served up four candidates that we felt very well met the criteria needed for the presidency. The Board of Regents looked at that list and decided they thought three of those four were worthy of consideration, and therefore they wished to interview. Two of those three declined to be in a pool of candidates. They would only be a candidate if there was one person in it, that being them. So at that point, we were at the where we had one candidate the board selected to interview, who agreed to be interviewed. And fortunately, it was an absolutely top candidate. So we're very pleased with the outcome.
Hey, Mr. Chair, can we do that
Thank
with
you
elections?
Very much.
It works great. That way where I come from.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Pawlowski has a question.
Mr. Chair, President Brunix, you may recall that in November of 2006, you visited my classroom at Winona Senior High during my prep hour to discuss issues of higher education. And I just wanted to say that during the time you've been president of the University of Minnesota, you have displayed an exemplary interest in what happened in classrooms at the graduate, undergraduate, and K-12 level. And I understand you may be returning to the classroom when you leave the presidency. And I would hope you'd have the opportunity to do that, because it would be a shame not to share all of the experiences that you've had with students after you leave the presidency. And I just wanted to thank you for that visit, because I only had a 50-minute prep hour, and the issues were of some importance. And it is remembered in Winona that you did that. Thank you.
Well, it's one of the great conversations that I can recall in my experience in this position. And I will tell you, in my 42 years, it's very unusual for someone to serve in one place for 42 years. And it was not a hard decision for me to make, because I fell in love with the University of Minnesota in this state when I first arrived, and never lost any degree of my affection. But I can tell you that some of the finest moments I've experienced in my life have been in classrooms with students, engaging with students. And I've, despite spending some time in administration, close to 35 years, I really miss it, and I'm looking forward to going back. And I must tell you, I'm still working on my incomplete for your course.
President Brunix, I was going to add that if you need a reference, I think you can contact this committee. And we'll
good. I hope so. I hope I'm still in good standing here.
Representative Rukavina.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And President Brunix, I just want to thank you for your years of service, too. And, well, at times we always haven't agreed. I have to say that, you know, you were a pretty fair, open-minded person who was always willing to come and sit down and listen. And in fact, you're going to be coming around to my office next week to talk about an issue of importance. You know, I have some new invasive species up in my lakes too, but I don't think you can do anything about it. They're called Republican cabin owners. So, is there anything you can do about that? But on a more serious note, here, you know, this afternoon and maybe even shortly, we have a bill coming, and we're going to be cutting, Mr. Berg, I think, $185 million from the two systems. And my numbers here, I think, are accurate that, you know, the university is going to be getting about $22 million then at that point when we make the cuts, less than you did in the 10-11 budget, and about $192 million almost less than when I first got the chair and we had a little bit of money 1 year and tried to bring you back up to where you were way back in probably 01 and 02. So when we cut you this afternoon, which I'm sure it's going to pass, and the Minsky system also, but I want to know from you, from the heart, to tell us, you know, who's going to get hurt the most? Is it going to be the students? Is it going to be research? Is it going to be the faculty? Is it going to be the programs offered to the bright people that are, you know, starting their careers? Is it going to be Minnesota's economy? How are you going to handle those cuts? Who's going to hurt the most?
President Brunix.
Chair Norris, Representative Rukavina, it's a very hard question to ask, but I think it's going to be all of the above, to be honest with you. I've had just a little time to look at the bill. It looks like a bill that makes a significant effort to address the $6 billion budget deficit, but we still have about 5/6 of the problem ahead of us, it looked like to me. And what worried me a little bit about what I saw is in this first $1 billion cut, 18.5% of it was coming out of higher education. Higher education represents now about 9% or 9.5% of the state's budget. So I felt the reduction was extraordinarily deep on higher education. And what worries me is the long-term trajectory as we deal with the bigger remaining problem that we have before us. But I've had lots of meetings with this faculty and staff at the University of Minnesota. We've talked very seriously about that these reductions that we expect will be a part of our conversation in the next several months are likely to have a real impact on their welfare. We very likely could see wage and salary freezes, some take back and benefits and benefit costs. I mean, all of that I think is very much in the equation. We will do our level best to deal with economic adversity by taking about two-thirds of it out of our hides, by reducing programs, reducing costs. We've really gone after the cost centers of the University of Minnesota. Deferring badly needed investments. One of the areas that where I think we get hurt on the research side is if we can't continue to invest and refresh the workforce of the University of Minnesota, we could fall behind very, very quickly. But I don't think you're going to see the university respond by putting extraordinary burden on students and families. I think there's no question in my mind that if you push hard and cut the budget of the university deeply, we're going to have to look to tuition for some of the solution. There's no question about that. But we're going to try what we can. We're going to try to do everything we can do to make sure that particularly students of modest means have the opportunity for the brass ring and have the opportunity for an education at the university. But it's going to hurt all of the things you mentioned. All of those are critical aspects of the university's mission and responsibilities. And what deeply worries me is I don't see near-term solutions to the problem you're talking about unless we rethink the Minnesota tax system and we put some revenues into the equation as well. I'm not a high tax person, but I do believe that in times of economic adversity, we're all in this boat together, and we all need to figure out ways to get through this patch, this rough patch, and maintain the strength of the core infrastructure we have in our own state. So in answer to your question, I'm deeply worried about this initial round of cuts. They will have some impact. But I'm leaving here today with a higher degree of anxiety about the possible reductions that could follow this piece of legislation. And I hope you'll do everything you can to find solutions other than an 18.5% reduction on the university's base going forward. That, to me, would have devastating consequences for our future.
Thank you, President Brunix. We have... Representative Norton, did you have a question?
Well, I just wanted to follow up on that a little bit, if I could, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Dr. Brunix, one of the comments that I've heard made about this is the proposed cuts, which you know we've just taken a look at today and are perhaps going to be dealt with later this evening, are expected in that you've been planning for them. And so I would like you to address that. Is this what you expected, and have you planned for it already, or are you just going to start that process, or have your predecessor... fill in, and then and I guess I would just say too, and we'll talk about this later, I think you're right, this is just there's 5-6 left to go, and I'm afraid it is just the start. So I wondered if you could just comment on, have you planned for this?
President Brunix.
Chair Norris, Representative Norton, we have obviously been working nonstop. Every day we get up and work on these challenges and issues. We have the cost increases at a place like ours are not sort of within the CPI. We invest in the most sophisticated laboratories and buildings, and we have to maintain the kind of core infrastructure that supports the type of work we do. It takes about $90 million of new investment every year at the University of Minnesota across the state to maintain our quality and maintain our productivity. And we are already cutting back on and have made very serious cuts in the kind of investment we hope to make. We are talking about compensation limits, on faculty and staff, our workforce of close to 19,000 people. So we have been preparing for what we think will be a pretty tough sledding here in the next few months. And I think that's just normal. Now, I must tell you, I was hoping to get out of Dodge without having to deal with this set of issues. I think our Board of Regents would say the same thing. But I expect when you put final pen to this budget that 70 to 80% of the challenge will be in the first year of the biennium. That's just typically the way you budget at the state legislature, and that means before I leave office, I will have to put the solution on the table with my talented colleagues and the support of the Board of Regents. So most of the heavy lifting for the next 2 years will have to be done between now and July. So we are preparing for various contingencies, but I'm pleading with you today to do everything possible to work, join hands, work across the aisle, figure out ways to really come up with solutions that are going to benefit us in the long term, and by all means do everything you can to make sure that we support the core infrastructure of the university. There's always a way to trim your sails and reduce costs, but there aren't a lot of easy solutions left. This will be the third time in 10 years we've been doing this at the University of Minnesota, and the low-hanging apples have been picked. It's not as easy to make these cuts now, and as Representative Rukavina stated so well in his question, there's a whole range of adverse impacts that we can expect to see if these cuts become far deeper than the bill that you have before you.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to follow up on Representative Norton's question. President Brunix, I'm actually looking at a newspaper report from today about your testimony yesterday in the Senate. And if this has it right, I think you may have mentioned if the cuts that are being proposed in House File 126, if that were to be the end, tuition increases might stay in the single digits. But if a significant later cut comes, we might be talking about more significant tuition increases at the university. I was just wondering, does the story have that right? Is that your concern, that a second round, a deeper round, could really impact students?
President Bruni?
Chair Nernis, Representative Morrow, it definitely does. And it adversely affects students in two ways. One might be upward pressure on tuition rates. If those cuts are really deep, you have a very difficult decision to make about whether you increase those costs to students and families, or do you accept the inevitability of deep declines in the level of service. So you're already charging people a fair amount of money to come to the University of Minnesota. If you can't deliver the goods, you're in real jeopardy and you're in real trouble, I think. So that's one concern I have, and the other is the rising cost for students and the inability of the state and the federal government and the University of Minnesota to mitigate those costs, particularly for students from low and moderate income backgrounds. So I think that's a correct characterization, but I went on to say in my post-testimony interview with one of the media outlets that we are going to do everything possible to keep these rate increases in the single-digit range. I can't tell you what they'll be right now. It depends on how things unfold in the next several months. But we have really made access and affordability big issues at the University of Minnesota. I'm really proud that over 70% of the students attending our campuses are Minnesota residents. Unlike some states, we haven't tried to balance our budget on the backs of out-of-state students. We really believe we have a real responsibility to our state in making sure that access remains strong for Minnesota residents, and I think that investment will pay off for us and pay off for our state. But I'm deeply worried about it.
Representative Atkins, do you have a short question?
Thank you. Yeah, Mr. Chairman. And President Brunix, when House File 126 was proposed, I assume they visited with you, is there a reason that it was given to you as to why higher ed was singled out for the kind of the double blow? I mean, you're 9% of the budget, but you're taking 18% of the cut in a time when we're trying to create jobs and build Minnesota's economy. I'm just curious if you had an explanation that was given to you as to what's behind House File 126.
Chair Nernis, Representative Atkins, I didn't have any specific consultation on the House File you're referencing. But I will tell you that I've become increasingly concerned in the last, I'd say, 5 to 10 years that public leaders are not putting higher education on what I consider to be a sufficiently high priority list for the future of our state. It's not uncommon if you ask a public official running for office to state what their top four or five priorities are, to have those priorities listed without mentioning higher education. I don't think you can do that in the 21st century. You could have gotten away with it in the 19th century. You could have gotten away with it in the 20th century, perhaps, at least in the early part of the century, but you can't get away with it in a global economy that requires innovation and brain power, highly skilled workforce. And that doesn't mean we have everything right in higher education, that we have our priorities lined up exactly in the right way, that we can't make change and we can't achieve economies. I'm here to tell you we've got to set priorities and we need to make some hard choices. But what worries me is it's not visible enough, that is, higher education is not visible enough as a long-term priority for the future of this state. And to me, I find that an untenable proposition. If you expect our children to inherit the kind of economy and quality of life that we enjoy today in the decades ahead, it just simply won't happen. Now, I don't have any magic panacea. I think there are a lot of solutions, a lot of ideas. We've talked about a good many of them here this afternoon that I think we could employ to do our job better and perhaps use our resources more effectively, but there's no alternative to invest in our educational infrastructure in Minnesota. We will not be able to cut our way to the future. We'll cut our way to the bottom, but we won't cut our way to the top. We're going to have to trim sails, but also invest at the same time.
Well, Mr. Chair, just one brief
Representative
anecdote.
Atkins, we're really running short on time. Go ahead.
Yeah, I get that. We've got 3 minutes left. This will take 60 seconds, Mr. Chairman. I've got three young people that spent a lot of time, just very anecdotal, but three folks that spent some time in the lower level of my house. One's my son, two of his friends, all low 30s on their ACTs, all accepted either at the Carlson School or the Science and Technology School, but also at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which is tearing his father's heart out, I might add. One had an interview this past weekend with one of the Ivies. They are aware of this discussion. They read the paper. And as you take Minnesota's best and brightest, at least the other two, I don't know about my kid, but they're thinking about where they're going to go, and they are the human capital that we talk about. And then we talk about whacking higher ed twice as hard as we're going to whack anyplace else. And now you've got these young people that they have other options. My request of you or some of your able staff, we talked about the university in somewhat of a vacuum today, but I'm curious relative to the institutions that you compete against. Certainly, our folks in the Badger State next door, but those other institutions, how are we holding up against the product that they're putting forth? Because at the end of the day, I'm afraid that we're going to lose our best and brightest, and they're going to end up opening their businesses and becoming entrepreneurs in Madison, Wisconsin, or in New Haven, Connecticut, or elsewhere, rather than here in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chair Nardis, Representative Atkins, I'll just take a couple minutes. I think if you look at the indicators that we would use to answer your question, you know, the quality indicators, that the preparation of the class, the quality indicators, the progress toward degree, the accomplishments of our students, you'd have to say that we're definitely gaining, and we're gaining on the competition, and we're winning far more than we're losing. So that's what puts so much of this at stake. If a young person decides to stay in Minnesota, go to a college or university here, graduate here, they have about a 70% probability of staying in this state and contributing to our economy and quality of life. If they go out of state, I have three sons, they all went to school someplace else, two of them on athletic scholarships. So, and they're living someplace else. Actually, one's in Minnesota. He's a professor at Concordia College. But, you know, if you go out of state, you have a high probability of staying someplace else and contributing to that state's economy or that country's economy. So this is really all about building the brain power that we need in our state to really succeed in the 21st century. But I'd have to say, I wouldn't have said this 25, 30 years ago, but I can say it with real assurance today that we are really winning this race to keep our very best students in Minnesota. And the satisfaction rates are at all-time levels with our graduates and particularly our entering freshmen. And so I would advise all three of these young people to select the University of Minnesota. They won't regret it.
I thought you might.
Thank you very much for your presentation. We're running short on time. In fact, we're about out of time, but I would officially like to move House File 126 and move recommend it pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And I'm speeding this up a little bit. Russ Stanton is here, would like to testify on this bill for a few minutes. He cannot return later this afternoon, so I'd like to squeeze him in here if we can, if you can stay for just a couple of more minutes.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Russ
is coming up. I was just wondering, is there a chance that we would meet right after session, or do you intend to convene at 5:30?
I think the published time was 5:30, so we need to probably stay with it. I know that's inconvenient for all of us, but we'll try to make it brief, hopefully.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'm sorry, and I don't want to take time from Mr. Stanton anyway, but I've got deep concern about this. This is a very significant bill. Mm-hmm. There's a very important question, and now you're trying to rush through testimony, not trying to be, if I could just finish my comment, in order to make sure that we get out of here in time. We want to make sure we clearly vet these issues. I don't know if there are other people in the room right now who would like to be able to testify as well. So I feel a need to at least express my deep concern about the speed, the rapidity of doing this.
Mr. Sam.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you very much for accommodating my schedule here. I appreciate it very much. You're always a very fair chair. For the record, my name is Russ Stanton. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization. For new members of the committee, the Interfaculty Organization is the union that represents the seven state university faculties. The bill before you, of course, would cut $47,921,000 from the MNSCU operation and maintenance budget. That's the money that goes to the campuses in both 2012 and 2013. I just want to point out that this is on top of numerous cuts that we've already suffered in recent years. In 2008, the MNSCU appropriation was $665 million. After a number of cuts, it's down to $605 million this year. And in fact, if the proposed cuts were to become law, it would bring our appropriation base down to about what our appropriation was 10 years ago in fiscal year 2001. Now, that wouldn't be so bad, except you have to consider the enrollment issue, because in 2001 we had 118,000 full-time equivalent students in MNSCU. Now we have 158,000, so that's 40,000 new FYE students since 2001 on about the same appropriation, and that's the equivalent of several large universities that we're talking about. And the result is that the per pupil funding has dropped from about $48.77 per student down to $38.31. So that's about $1,000 per student less appropriation than back in 2001. Certainly the state of Minnesota has serious, serious budget problems, but I want to just point out that MNSCU didn't cause them. Over the years, the MNSCU appropriations as a percent of the state budget has fallen constantly from about 4.56% of the general fund down to 3.15% this year. Also, if you go to the MNSCU dashboard accountability tool on their website, you'll see that not only are our instructional costs far below the national average, we're near the bottom in terms of our instructional cost at state universities. The economic meltdown that triggered this shortfall isn't the problem of any, it wasn't caused by anyone in this room, but we're all going to have to share the pain, and I just want to let you know that we have been sharing the pain. The faculty negotiated 0 and 0 for pay increases this biennium. We're seeing substantial cuts in positions. We lost 80 positions this year at Mankato, 80 positions at St. Cloud, 30 at Bemidji, 37 at Moorhead, and we still have Southwest and Winona that are in the process of doing their reorganization. You know, these cuts are going to hurt students, they're going to hurt faculty, but in the end, the real loser is going to be the state of Minnesota. There was recently this Georgetown University study of the workforce needs for the state of Minnesota. In the next decade, and by 2018, they're saying we should have 70% of our workforce with at least some sort of post-secondary education. You know, we're, I think, in the high 40s right now. We're simply not going to meet the workforce needs of the future if we keep cutting higher education. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate the accommodation here.
Thank you very much. We'd like to call on Jim Erickson for just a moment. Do we have some Board of Regents candidates? Some maybe still in the room. Maybe some have left. Can you quickly introduce them, Jim?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Erickson from the Regents Candidate Advisory Council. Our chair, Jane Balow, is here, too. Where did she go? Well, maybe she went upstairs. You and I are both due upstairs right now.
Right.
So I'll take 1 minute to introduce to you the faces or the name, the faces on the names that have been calling you for interviews. We are forwarding to you and have forwarded you 12 wonderful names, and some of them are in the room. So let me just to get a chance to introduce them. In the for the at-large position, Regent Steve Hunter is seeking reappointment. Where did he leave? I saw him leave a moment ago, but you know him. And in the 8th District, Alan Anderson is traveling. I don't think Robert Kennedy is here, that I have seen him. In the 2nd District, Laura Broad, who you know, who many of you know very well, is traveling in business. But Tom Devine, a candidate, is here. And maybe he thought we were going to start at 2:15, too. And Dr. Roby Thompson is here. Please, would you indicate, wave so that they know when you call for an appointment, Doctor? And in the 8th Congressional District, William Burns, will you please stand up, please, Mr. Burns? Robert Kennedy, again, the president of Maine, the University of Maine is not here. Dave McMillan from Duluth. Dave, would you stand up and so they know who will be coming to see them? And Robert Osland, I don't believe is here. So thank you for the moment. These are names that will be coming to talk to you from the candidates that you will be selecting from.
All right. With that, we'll be in recess then until 5:30. I'd like to reconvene the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee and continue our discussion on House File 126. Appreciate, first of all of you being here. I know it's late. Your cars are probably idling in the parking lot.
They should be.
I know. Be sure you have a full tank when you leave for home. Anyway, we did have just a brief amount of testimony earlier this afternoon. And I guess at this point I'd like to maybe call your attention to a very, very tiny spreadsheet that's in your packet. So we can... And if you find that, I'd like to have Doug Berg, explain.
Let him go.
If you'd like to do that,
Mr. Chair, members, there is a three-page spreadsheet in your packet that's labeled House File 126 Budget Reductions, and then you'll say it says Article 1 Higher Education. This, of course, is House File 130 has this plus several other articles that have passed in other committees, the Tax Committee and Human Services Committee and State Government Committee. This will be Article 1 of that bill as well. What it does, you'll see, is a reduction in the base, the forecast base for the University of Minnesota of $44,606,000 each year in fiscal years 12 and 13 for a total of $89.2 million. And at MinSCU, it reduces their base by $47,921,000 each year in fiscal 12 and 13 for a total of $95.8 million. The bill total will be a $185 million reduction from the forecast spending base in 2012-13. And very briefly, I'll make two other comments that I told the chair I would because there's been some confusion. There's a lot of discussion about this cutting appropriations. We have, of course, not yet appropriated any money for this biennium, so we are not, in fact, cutting appropriations here. We are cutting their forecast spending base for the next biennium. That will reduce the gap between forecast expenditures and forecast revenues in the February forecast, should this become law. the committee will then subsequently have to appropriate some amount of money to these systems. This bill does not appropriate any money, nor does it cut any money that's currently appropriated.
No,
neither. That said, there's also some confusion about the bill itself. If you look at it, this is an amendment to a bill which passed last year in special session, which cut $50 million from the University of Minnesota and $50 million from the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities in fiscal 2011. Those were actual reductions of actual appropriations. And if you look at it, the specifications of where they were goes down. It's there. In the case of the university, there are cuts to the specials at the UN, there are O&M, and at the case of Minsky, there was a cut to their O&M and a specified cut to the board office budget. In the bill in special session, several cuts were allowed to roll forward into the base in 12 and 13. The cut to the Minsky system office did roll forward into the 12 and 13 base and reduced it for them. The cuts to the University of Minnesota specials did roll forward into the base in 12 and 13 and cut the base of the specials at the university. What the bill before you now does on lines 1.20 and 2.10, those are the only changes in this bill. It reduces the O&M base for the U of M and Minsky for 12 and 13. And the number it reduces it by is the balance of the $50 million in both cases that did not roll forward. So in the case of Minsky, it's the $50 million minus the $2,079,000 in cuts to the central office that we did take out of the base for the $47.9 million at Minsky. And in the case of the university, it reduces the $50 million minus the five-some million that in special cuts that rolled forward for the balance of that cut being $44.6 million. In aggregate, then, this bill from last year and the amendment to it, or the amendment we're about to take up on it, would in aggregate then reduce each system $50 million each year of the next biennium. I can see from Representative Morrow that was not clear.
Representative Morrow, you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I actually have a procedural question. If you could just maybe remind me, maybe some of the new folks, on what your size committee practices are on fiscal notes. When requesting fiscal notes, presenting fiscal notes, would this be an appropriate time to be presenting a fiscal note on this bill? And if not, if you could just explain when that will happen.
There's no standard.
Yeah. I don't think in this case it's necessary. The bill basically spells that out.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I'd request a roll call, please. Is that okay?
Roll call will be in.
And then, Mr. Chairman, I see this spreadsheet. I was curious where the initially, Doug, I think you said a three-page spreadsheet. I think you mean a three-line spreadsheet. But I would like to reflect that we're evidently going to be asked to take a vote without knowing what the individual impact is on individual campuses. I don't know what the impact at Inver Hills is, or St. Cloud State, or Wilmer, or Bemidji, or any of those places.
Well, Representative Atkins, you know, we're doing what we did last May, and I think we voted at that time essentially for the same bill, maybe without knowing the answers that you're asking for now.
No, Mr. Chairman. I was in office, and I remember looking at those numbers because I represent Inver Hills, and I was quite concerned about Inver Hills.
It wouldn't change.
I didn't memorize the number, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, and I suspect a few new members. And I'll look across the table. Do you guys know what the impact on your individual campuses are? Anybody? Or are you just going to vote? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I should go through the chair, but
okay.
I'm a little frustrated at that. I sort of anticipated seeing that in the packet. And for that reason alone, I expect to oppose.
I think several members have visited with their colleges. Not all, maybe, but some. But again,
last I checked, Mr. Chairman, I got this late in the evening yesterday and just sort of anticipated that we would see the runs today.
Yeah.
I apologize. I should not have assumed that we would be asked to vote without knowing the impact on campuses, but it seems to me that it was a fairly straightforward piece of information that we would have been provided with.
I'm not sure, and maybe Mr. Bird could confirm, I'm not sure that we've done that in the past. Have we gotten a campus-by-campus report on the results of what we're doing here?
Chair.
Representative Rukavina?
Chair, if my memory serves me correct, neither Mr. Bird or Ms. Novak can correct me. We had asked for some information in the 09 bill that they report to us. I believe it was March 1st or 15th. Maybe one of you can help me. There was a date in the bill. What the effect would be on campuses, we asked it for the Minsky system, and we all did get those numbers.
We do have it.
That's what Representative Adkins is referring to. So you knew what theoretically they might, what Fergus Falls was told to cut, and how they were going to approach their cuts, and I knew what Mesabi, and you knew what Inverted Hills was, and
we do have a testifier. Maybe can help answer some of this. Laura King is here from Minsky. Would you like her to address this?
Yeah, it's not my question.
Or if in the very least, I mean, if everybody else is comfortable voting for it, I know I'm voting against it, so that makes it easy. But it would be nice to at least get that information, even post-hearing. If you're committed to voting for it and it's going to get done, I understand that. And I've been here long enough that I recognize the votes are probably there to pass the bill, Mr. Chair. So the second question is, I'm comfortable getting that information afterwards. Second question that I had, though, is what's the philosophy behind cutting higher ed twice as much as it represents in the budget? And it may, you know, and you can certainly respond if you want to, that that's what you did last time. This is your bill, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. You're cutting 18% when higher ed is only 9% of the budget. What we all talk about as we ran for election, has been job creation, help the entrepreneurs. We talked about it earlier with President Bronix. Why whack the one area in our budget that actually is, and doubly whacked when we're talking about these are the job creators?
Well, I don't know if I've got a good answer for you. This is my bill, I guess, but it's not really. I mean, this has been just a continuation again of what we did last year. We wanted to make it permanent last year. We couldn't do that. Now we're just simply saying we'd like to do that as a way of beginning the process of balancing this huge, huge deficit. And so that's where this came from. We're just basically doing what we did last May, only now we want to make it permanent instead of just the one time. So that's where it came from.
Then the final question I'd have, Mr. Chair, is when we get to the House floor, whose bill is it? Who should I ask that question of?
Well, I suppose I can take charge at that point.
Okay.
If you want to target.
I don't want to target, I just want an answer. There's clearly a philosophy that we're going to cut this area twice as much as it represents in the budget. I just want to know why.
Representative Adkins, it will be our bill. It'll be the higher education bill, whether you are, you know, voting for it or against it. It will be our bill when it gets there. And we'll have to be responsible for that.
Fair enough.
Yes. Okay. Some of us are running out of gas out in the parking lot, but anyway. Rukavini, were you...
I'm just getting started.
Mr. Chair, I just want a clarification maybe from staff here. But, you know, we had hoped that when we came in, we're not doing what we did last year here. We are permanently cutting, $50 million, but I'm assuming that these other cuts where this language is, Mr. Berg, if you can help me out, then we'll carry forward, and that we will permanently be cutting $2,079,000, and they won't be charged back either. Do we have to do that again in another bill? And the same with the University of Minnesota on those specials that we addressed. But we built the base back up for the coming biennium in anticipation that we thought, I mean, Democrats were not going to try to hit students and the systems any more than we possibly could. So we built an increase back to well, these numbers here that you're cutting permanently now. So there is a difference. So when you're talking about we, I don't know, you know, if I'm with you on that, because we collectively did not anticipate cutting university and the Minsky system permanently in these numbers. And, you know, there are going to be repercussions. I don't know if the Minsky system and the university want to come forward and answer what the total, if they want to raise this money back just by tuition, what those increases would be in either one of those systems. But I'm assuming they would be both in double digits. I'm looking around here. Laura says no. Triple digits? So what? So, but anyway, you know, it's not, what you're doing here is making permanent cuts that we hoped we could reach an agreement and raise some revenue and make some cuts. And there is no big picture here. I don't know if also the question is if we cut the university and the Minsky system at a as big a percentage of the cuts being made in your total bill, not just this one, but the other tax bills and that coming forward, the total cuts, if our cuts to higher education were double what they got of general fund money. And maybe Mr. Berg knows the answer to that. But
before he answers
And then finally, Mr. Chair, I didn't vote for the cut bill. I had enough of cuts.
I know that.
So I didn't vote for any of the cuts. Right. I didn't vote for my own bill because I was tired of making cuts and I want some revenue, you know. You guys accuse me of being a tax and spend liberal, but I'm kind of a tax and spend progressive libertarian. But anyway, you know, I didn't anticipate these kind of cuts being permanent and moving forward, and you're going to have to cut again. So these are of a much greater magnitude.
I wanted to clarify something. The bill from here goes to the Ways and Means Committee and actually will be part of that committee. So it'll be actually Holbrook's committee, not our bill, not my bill. So just for clarification. So,
but
and Doug, would you, or Mr. Berg, would you have a response? To
Mr. Chair, on the couple of things that Representative Rukavina asked, first I will clarify again that the $2,079,000 cut to the central office at Minsky and the cuts to the specials at the university, those were permanent cuts when the bill passed last year and was signed into law. Those have always been permanent cuts.
That was the first part of my question.
And nothing new is happening here with that. Only the difference between those and the $50 million that was cut one time is now being moved forward to reduce the base of both systems. Second comment, your question you had was relative to if this money were levied back in tuition increases, what would that amount to? The number for that for Minsky is 6%, and the number for the U of M is 5.9% on that. Yeah, again, that's how much it would take if they chose to get this amount of money back out of tuition. And that, implying that they would do that, or that they just, that's how much it would be.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Berg, as a percentage of the budget, that question versus what this is in the cut bill from last year and its totality?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, I'm not exactly tracking what you're asking here.
What I'm asking, what Mr. Brunick pointed out this morning, that they're almost 8% of the general fund, and they're taking an 18% hit in the total cut bill that he was seeing. I don't think ours was that great last year.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, I didn't exactly track the president on that, because on my numbers, on an annual basis, this reduction is a 7.2% reduction to the Minsky base, and it is I believe it's 6.9 at the university. In each year, so I didn't quite track.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Berg, I think he was saying of the total cut bill that's going through.
We're 18%. It's possible we're 18% of the total cut.
That's what he's asking.
I don't know the answer to that.
But my question to you is, were we a disproportionate cut last year as a percentage of the budget and the cuts? Because I don't think we were.
I can't answer that off the top of my head.
I was hoping you couldn't. Thank you. Because I don't think we were.
To this point, Connie, or Representative Demke?
Thank you
very
much.
Then we'll get to you.
Actually, it was a comment to Representative Atkins, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's my understanding, and I don't know if we saw last year a run on what each one of the universities, but it's my understanding in this bill that it's a cut to the particular university, and then they make the decision on which one of the schools is going to get cut. So we wouldn't be able to give you a run on it, that they would be giving you a run after they make the cuts. And correct me if I'm wrong on that, but that's my understanding of it.
Mr. Chair, Representative, with all due respect, I will correct you when you're wrong. My understanding from Mr. Berg is that it goes via a formula with respect to the Minsky system, and those numbers can be generated, and I see Ms. Novak nodding as well. And I would move to lay the bill over until we have the actual numbers before us. I don't think it's appropriate to be voting on a bill where you don't know what the individual impact is on the campuses that we represent. And I'll ask for a roll call, Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion before we ask for the roll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I am one of the freshmen that you are looking at, and I do think it probably will be easy to vote no on the issue, but I think the citizens of Minnesota, not just in District 2, are asking that all of us do our share in trying to control this budget. And sure, I need to look out for BSU, but I also want to look out for the taxpayers of Minnesota. And I don't think that it's fair for them to scrimp and save and live within their means and not expect their educational system and their government to do the same. So do I vote gladly? Yes. Not with enthusiasm, no, but I think it's a hard fact that we need to face, and the fact that you seem to be reluctant to face it, you have to live with that. I can live with my vote. Thank you.
The motion is to lay this on the table, and we will take the roll.
Chair Nornes?
No.
Representative Detmer? Representative Rukavina?
Aye.
Representative Atkins?
Aye.
Representative Banyan?
No.
Representative Benson?
No.
Representative Dowd?
No.
Representative Depke?
No.
Representative Hancock?
No.
Representative Mazarel?
No.
Representative Morrow?
Aye.
Representative Norton?
Aye.
Representative Pawlowski?
Yes.
Representative Poppy?
Aye.
Representative Vogel?
No.
The no is that it.
No. Okay, by a vote of 9-6, the nays have it. I wonder at this time if Laura King would like to come and present her testimony. Oh, before we do that, Representative Norton had a question. And sorry, it took a while to get to you.
That's all right. I can be patient. And thank you, Mr. Chair. I respect the conversation we've just had, and I know this is difficult. We've been cutting for a number of years now, and every year it's difficult, and it just seems to get more difficult every year. However, I personally ran on a balanced approach to budget, and the one thing I said I was going to protect was education, and that included higher education. And so for me, this is very difficult, and I'm not interested in increasing an already awful long-term cut. But my question, Mr. Chair, is we keep talking about this being phase one, and am I to understand that this is just the start and that there will be another cut to higher education this session, that we can expect additional cuts, and this is just the beginning? Because I'd really like, I mean, we're talking phase one and two, and I'm unclear as to whether you mean phase one or two to this bill and this committee, or if you're talking phase one and two in a more global manner. So I need to know, and I want to know if we'll be cutting further in this right. committee.
Representative Norton, in my judgment and my opinion would be that this is perhaps phase one, but in more of a global sense, not necessarily targeting higher education for phase one, two, three, or four. We won't know that until we actually have more information from the February forecast and a target and all kinds of things. So later on, we will have a better answer as to where we're going to have to go in this committee. But right now, we're calling it phase one, and that encompasses all of the cuts, not just the higher education. Well, it's the first attempt to balance the budget, and that's what we're trying to do.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, I'm hearing you say you're not for certain whether we'll be cutting again.
I don't think anyone knows.
Okay, and I guess that raises the second question, which is, if we don't have any budget targets yet, why aren't we waiting until we know more? Why are we moving ahead with, you know, kind of a number pulled out of the air, as far as I can tell, rather than having a budget target and working toward that?
Well, it's really just renewing basically the action of this legislature last May. So it's not pulling it out of the air. It's essentially, it's really probably the easiest thing that we'll be doing, because it's essentially just renewing the actions of our legislature as we ended last year.
Well, Mr. Chair, with all due respect, we've increased the numbers of the cuts, so it's not simply renewal, it's a renewal plus. And I guess I'm just going to reiterate, it seems premature to me. It seems to me like we should wait till we know more, we have our numbers, and we work in a meaningful and thoughtful way at that end. And for that reason alone, you know, I will be voting against this. I'm sure that's not a surprise to you, and it looks as though it's a foregone conclusion. But I just want to explain to you, I feel like we're doing this very quickly without the information we need to make correct decisions. Yeah.
Again, from the chair's perspective, I think the attempt is to actually do some work early in the session and do some things that we feel are necessary, and we'll do much harder work as we get further on into the session and no more. But in past sessions, as you know, we've waited for probably 2 months to do anything. This time we think this is a first step. The public is asking us to do this, and so that's the intent of us to get it done.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Clarification. These numbers in this bill that you say you are mirroring, and we're only doing what we did last year, these numbers were reached after much consideration, after looking at the whole budget, and after taking in the stimulus package, because there was a formula we couldn't go cut more than.
Right.
And so that's where these numbers came from. And Representative Norton is right. You're just grabbing a number and picking it, but these numbers were based on, we could only go down so far because of the stimulus money, and was based on, I think, our spending in 6 and 7 or whatever, and that's how we reached these numbers. You didn't reach these numbers by that. You just picked the number and said we'll start. And you know, when I was campaigning, I didn't hear any clamoring to go out there and increase tuition for college students. It's more than high enough. So I don't know about the public clamoring. They know we have to balance the budget. They also, if I remind this committee, elected a governor who wasn't afraid to say how he was going to balance the budget as far as raising some revenue, too, to do it. So I'm going to vote no, too, which is no surprise to anybody.
We're still waiting to hear from the governor.
That we agree.
Again, maybe at this
surprised.
Point.
I may vote yes after that.
At this point, I'd like to call on Laura King, if she still wants to testify. Were you? Okay. So you're welcome to step forward to the hot seat. Appreciate you staying around with us tonight.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for the invitation. Appreciate an opportunity just to say a word. I won't keep you long. I know your cars are all idling in the parking lot. I really just wanted to take a moment to talk a little bit about what the implications are of this bill for us. Mr. Berg did a nice job laying out the arithmetic. It's confusing because the numbers have been jumping around a lot in the last couple of years. We are currently funded at $605 million for fiscal 11, and this bill would have the result of taking that number down to $582 million in fiscal 12, which is slightly below our 2002 funding level. And as you heard the Chancellor in his remarks last week, we're managing with a 25% enrollment increase. So we have concerns about this, certainly. We understand that, certainly as anyone in this room does, we understand the dilemma the state is facing. We appreciate that we're part of the budget process, but we are obliged to share with you that our duty is to talk about how we can execute your mission for us, and as our resources are reduced, that execution becomes more and more difficult. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Any further questions? Representative Banio?
Thank you. I want to make sure I heard Vice King. Chancellor King correctly. We then, in Minsky, would face $23 million less in your base for FY12 and FY13 versus FY11. Did I hear you
Mr.
correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bannion, that's correct.
Okay.
Year over year.
So I'm trying to square this for myself. If we are extending, how do we account for that? Where's that $23 million coming from, please?
Welcome to the confusion of the numbers. I'm going to let Mr. Berg.
Oh yeah. By the way, Mr. Berg, if we had zero-based budgeting, this exercise wouldn't happen.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I was hoping to avoid trying to explain this briefly, but in fact, we cut twice last year. We cut $50 million from each system in this bill and special session, but we also cut $47 million collectively from the systems during the 2010 regular session. All right. The way that accrued, and there was reference to it, under the federal law, the stimulus law, we could not take the systems in aggregate below their 2006 funding level. That's where we got to and the governor had already announced his $50 million at each system on allotment. It was subsequently invalidated by the court, and then later in special session, we passed essentially the same cut again. In between there, we passed a cut which represented the rest of the money that we could get under federal law in 2011, which was $47 million. The way that accrued, if you just took them down to their 2006 system bases, was it was a $36 million cut from the university and a $10.5 million cut from MinSCU. In that bill, we cut in that fashion, 36 from the U and 10.5 from MinSCU, and all of that money was taken out of the base in 12 and 13, the full $47 million. But in order to even up in the out years, there was a discussion in conference that it really wasn't that fair that the U was paying a larger penalty in 2011 with 36 and 10 at MinSCU. So the collective amount of the cut in the out years, a little less than 47, was split between the two. So in the case of MinSCU, they had a $10 million reduction in 11, but a 22, almost $23 million a year reduction in 12 and 13. Then we passed this bill, the $50 million of which only a small portion hit them. Now if you put the rest of the 50 on, it's taking the same amount of money in a year, but it's falling on the two systems slightly differently. And it's bringing MinSCU $22 million below their current level, or below their current level. And in fact, the university would still stay just slightly above their current level, $10 million, because we effectively shifted $10 million of the university's cut in 11 to MinSCU in the tails for 12 and 13. Is that clear?
Representative Bannion.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Berg, believe it or not, yes, I actually got that. I don't know if anyone else did. I mean, it's a lot of numbers, but I'm just going to be clear about this. Voting for this bill does mean there's $23 million less that is in the forecasted number from which we'll be deriving a budget for 12-13 versus what they're receiving for fiscal year 11.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bannion, that's correct.
I would...
I'm sorry, I meant that for MinSCU. Actually haven't worked the math out for the University of Minnesota for fairly obvious reasons.
Because he has the chair, I have to, I think, say I'm very happy to have Mr. Berg with us. You're amazing. Also, I'd have to add that I don't think there's anybody here that likes this, that likes to cut. I don't think there's anybody on the committee that really enjoys doing this. But there's a certain amount of responsibility that I think we have to move forward in a difficult time. So, is there any other...
I'm not a anyone? Gas fine on this chair. I'm going to need a jump.
Anyone in the audience wants to add 2 cents? I don't see any. So at this point, I'll renew my motion that House File 126 be renewed to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, and we will have a roll call. Representative Banyan.
I wonder if I might say a few words about the bill generally before we proceed. I admit I'm absolutely torn by this, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to talk about it. One side, I see this is a good first step toward balancing a budget that we absolutely have to do. That's the job we're asked to do. We're working toward a good solution, which is release the resources of this state to the private sector, where productivity and creativity is great in increasing the standard of living for Minnesotans. My motto this time around has been 32 is enough. $32 billion is a good budget. We ought to be able to figure out a way to live under it. And there are hard choices to make. I've made a couple of votes today that have been hard to make, but I'm going to say tonight I'm not going there on this time around. When I ran for this office, I told citizens and colleagues I would be the face of what cuts in higher education are. I'm a public university professor. I represent folks, including folks at St. Cloud State University. We knew there were going to be cuts. We expect them. But I'm going to say my campus has experienced 80 faculty lines disappearing, including several of my friends and colleagues. Our classes are larger. Our ability to engage in research and community outreach is diminished. Time is the most precious commodity. And I won't talk much longer because it's your precious commodity, too. But 80 fewer faculty with an increasing student population costs us either in research, community outreach, or someplace else. While this bill removes the implied gain in base for fiscal years 12 and 13, we've just heard that it does cause a $23 million cut to MNSCU versus its fiscal year 11 budget. I know MNSCU's prepared for this, and I'm fine with that, but I don't think this is the right time or place to do it. Representative Atkins, you asked before why 18% of the cut is coming from 9% of the budget. I'll tell you why. We protected parts of the budget from cutting before. I want to have a full discussion about all those parts as we try to reach to 32. And so I'm going to vote no on this bill because I want to have that full discussion. And I thank you for the time and hope we can all get to our cars while we still have gas.
Any other comments from members? If not, I believe we are ready to vote. Take the roll.
Chair Nornes?
Yes.
Representative Detmer?
Yes.
Representative Rukavina?
No.
Representative Atkins?
No.
Representative Banyan?
No.
Representative Benson?
Yes.
Representative Doubt?
Yes.
Representative Depke?
Yes.
Representative Hancock?
Yes.
Representative Mazerall?
Yes.
Representative Morrow?
No.
Representative Norton?
No.
Representative Pawlowski?
No.
Representative Poppy?
No.
Representative Vogel?
Yes.
By a vote of 8-7, the bill passes and it moves on to Ways and Means. Thank you, members, for being here tonight.
Okay, we'll but if I beat you home, you got to switch your vote. Is that a deal?
I'm going to pick up my wife yet. Meeting is over.